Well, good morning. Chair Hass is delayed and has traffic issues. I'm not laughing. I told you I wouldn't laugh. So we're going to start this morning. We're going to change the schedule a little bit. This is the revenue, the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. We're going to start with Senate Bill 1565 this morning. We're going to hold a public hearing on that bill this morning. We don't have all the paperwork, so we won't be able to get it all the way through today, but we'll do the, we'll start with the public hearing on that bill. We have seven people signed up, so we have a few folks that have driven more than 100 miles. We're going to start with those folks. So Rick Molliton. Oh, I'm sorry. We have to, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1565.
All right.
Nice.
I'm getting into this now. So
we don't get to use these things very often. So public hearing on 1565. Rick Molliton and Brad Irwin, can come on up, please.
Do you want to talk about it first, then talk about the
bill? Oh, and while you're doing that, I will have Mr. Olenek talk about the bill.
You got to help.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So just very briefly, what the bill does is it changes the rates of compensation paid by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to distillery retail outlets, agents for distillery, the liquor retail sales by agent.
Vice Chair Findlay, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman here this morning representing the Oregon Distillers Guild. If you wouldn't mind, Mr. Vice Chair, letting me do a little setup and turn it over to the two folks who have traveled great distances to be with you this morning. First of all, I want to thank Chair Hass and members of the committee for hearing this bill today, and thank many of you on the committee who are sponsors of this legislation, along with thanking Senator Lee Beyer, who has just been a great champion for the distilling industry, has really worked diligently on this issue for the last 2 years, and we've been working on it for the last 2 years, and think that we've come up with a legislative proposal this year that really strikes the right balance. The issue of new compensation policy for tasting room distillery sales is something that has been identified as the most important issue for the Oregon distilling industry. Distillers were allowed to sell their own products out of their own tasting rooms. These are products that they make and sell at the tasting rooms they have. It was more or less put in the liquor store compensation model, which is all about high volume sales, generating significant revenue for the state. Unfortunately, that just doesn't work for distillers because their business model for these tasting rooms is not about high volume sales. It's about being able to market and promote their product and build brand awareness so they can build more loyal customers and generate more sales both in the state and throughout the country. The problem is that the compensation model that exists today, none of the distillers in the state make any money. They all lose money, and therefore they're not allowed to expand those operations where they can be economically viable to support the industry. What we have today is a proposal that's very simple in Senate Bill 1565, which changes that compensation formula. Today, distillers receive around 17% of the bottle price as their compensation for selling that spirit out of their own tasting room. And this amount needs to cover all of their expenses, from rent to putting lights on to paying staff to taxes, all of those things. And again, it just is not profitable. What we would do with this legislation, as you can see in the handout, is that we would change it to allow for them to keep 45% of the bottle price as their compensation, and thus generating the profitability in the tasting room where they can expand that operation. We have several distillers here today to share with you why this is so important to the industry, how they would use those resources to help grow this industry. And so I'll turn it over to them in just a moment. Let me just finally say, I've been working on alcohol policy in the state of Oregon for a number of years. And one thing that I can say is that we've got an incredibly successful beer and wine industry in this state, craft beer and wine industry in particular. And that's because Oregon policymakers over the decades have given these industries the tools they need to succeed. And you can look at legislative initiatives over the years that have helped those industries grow and expand, and look where they are today. The distillers really have not come to Salem to say, we need help with something, and they're here today. And this is the most important issue for their industry. So with that, I'll turn it over to Brad Irwin, who is the president of the Oregon Distillers Guild.
Thank you. Thank you, Senators. Good morning. My name is Brad Irwin, and I am the president of the Oregon Distillers Guild. And also I own Oregon Spirit Distillers in Bend. I've been in business for 10 years and we produce a fine whiskey that's distributed throughout a lot of the country. First of all, I'd like to make sure that everybody's aware of the importance of a tasting room. A tasting room is not a vehicle for generating sales per se. It's a vehicle for building a brand. And all 100 distilleries in, or 100 tasting rooms in Oregon are there to help us connect with customers and help them to develop an affinity for our products. And so it's really not where we generate a great deal of income. It's also very difficult for us to be paying a 33% tax on all those spirits that we generate. And two years ago when we started this initiative to really find out what we can do to help the distillers, we pooled our membership and we asked them, what is the one thing that we could do to help you to grow your businesses? Unanimously, they said, help us get some tax relief in the tasting room. We said, what's the second most important thing? And they said, there is no second and there is no third. So then we asked another question, and we asked them, if we were to allow you to keep some of the more compensation from your bottle sales out of your tasting rooms, what would you do with that money? And there were three things that were almost evenly split amongst our membership. Number one was hire more people or pay them more. Number two was invest in agriculture, in Oregon-grown agriculture. And number three was invest in equipment that would help us to grow our businesses. Spirit in Oregon will never produce viable business models off Oregonians. That's not what this industry is about. In order for us to be successful, we need to expand our businesses outside of Oregon, regionally, nationally, and internationally. And Oregon has the resources for us to do that. But the first thing that we need to do is be able to stand up in our tasting rooms, pay our staff, interact with our customers, and start to build brands. We see in my distilleries in Bend, 50% of the people who I see in my tasting room are from outside of the state of Oregon. They're people from Seattle, San Francisco, Atlanta, coming to visit, and they want to take Oregon, something, a story and a product, back to their home, and I hope that it can be a product of Oregon. I hope that it can be something that's made here using our agriculture. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. And if we may pause just a second, Senator Manning came by and he'd like to speak on this measure, and he's got a tight clock. So if we could, before we start with you, Mr. Moulton, let's have Mr. Manning, or Senator Manning, speak.
Mr. Chair, esteemed committee members, good morning. For the record, my name is James Ivory Manning, Jr. I am the senator from Senate District 7, Northwest Eugene, up to including Junction City and Lancaster. Since I'm in the Senate, I won't say that I have the best Senate district. I think that some way may take issue with that. So, well, with that, I want to just make brief comments. I have another committee that I have to get to, but I wanted to be here because I really support this bill. There's been a lot of work that has been done on it. Oh, so joined by Senator Byers. A lot of work that has been put in on this bill to try to make it fair for all. In my district, I have a number of distillers, and, listen to some of the stories that it costs to even run one place is really a challenge. I think it is a business that's growing, thriving, and it is a job creator. So I'm hoping that you will see your way to support this bill and pass it out of committee. With that, I'll turn it over to Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Senator.
Well, thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, it's Lee Byers, Senator from District 6. which incidentally is probably the best Senate district in the state.
All right, now.
Now that I've started off badly. Senators, this is a project that I have been working on with the Distillers Guild for about four sessions now, and we think we finally hit the sweet spot, and I hope you'll agree with that. My intent in starting to work on this was recognizing that we have an emerging industry in Oregon that's frankly pretty wrapped up in state and federal regulation that's very hard to deal with, makes it hard to work with them. And really, as Senator Manning said, we're trying to achieve some semblance of balance here. As you're well aware, we've grown the craft beer business. We've grown the wine business, and within the last two sessions, we've attempted to grow the cider business in the state, giving them significant help on the front end to allow them to grow. This is in the same vein, and it's within the same parameters industry, the distilled spirits industry. It's a little harder working with the distilled spirits because of federal law and the way that Oregon has chosen to control distilled spirits, in that we are the sole distributor of distilled spirits, which makes it much more difficult. You're probably familiar with this, but in case you're not, let me be real clear. The way we work the process is the distillers produce their product, whether they're in-state, out-of-state, or international. They transport it to OLCC's warehouse. It's a bonded warehouse. And then OLCC is the exclusive distributor of the product to through our agent stores. And for the privilege of doing that, we mark the product up 100% on average. And obviously, OLCC has some cost of handling that product. And once they sell it, then on average, they remit to a percentage of that. In the case of the small distillers, it works out to about 17% is what they get back on that. However, if you're a small distiller, your problem is you can't easily get somebody to handle your product like the big guys do. You have to do it yourself. You have to take it to OLCC, or a couple of years ago, we made some provision that they could have tasting rooms, and in fact, some of the places that are very remote may distribute the product directly to the stores in their area or what have you. They don't get any extra compensation for doing that. They're covering all their marketing costs and everything. The problem is if you're really small, it's hard to get customer understanding or acceptance that your product's there. And in most cases, the product that our Oregon-based distillers are making, it's a niche product, and it's a premium product that generally is selling for 50 to 200% above the price of a companion product like an Absolut Vodka or Jack Daniels, that sort of thing. So it's a tougher. The theory or concept, if you will, that we're proposing with this is that we can help these small distillers, if they choose to, give them a break to help them with their marketing by allowing them to do tasting rooms. Now, the problem with that is there's not enough money in it at the start to do that. So what this bill attempts to do is to say on the first $250,000 in sales, they can keep all but 5% of that markup, which is intended generally to allow them to have a staff person that could run their tasting rooms to do that. Anything above that goes to what's now they're getting is about the traditional markup. So it puts that in statute. So that's kind of the intent of this. I know that there is a projected revenue impact on this one. I would argue a bit with that. I would say it's indeterminate. And the reason I would say that is if we are successful in this effort, as we have been with the distillers, you're going to, over time, actually increase sales. And really the goal is to develop a Oregonian preference for a locally produced whiskey or vodka or what have you over an international brand. So we're actually, we may have some displacement, but it's at a higher price. Instead of selling a $15 bottle of vodka, we may sell a $40 bottle of Klamath Falls vodka. You know, so that's kind of the concept there. Very hard to really say how much of that will happen. The other argument that I would make is that if you visited these tasting rooms, much as if you go wine tasting, you probably end up buying a bottle of product that you otherwise wouldn't have bought. So there's going to be some increased sales from that as well. So that's essentially the point of doing this. I'm going to argue that at the end of the day, I think, maybe not the end of today, but you know, in a few years, what you may actually see is an increase in sales and an increase in revenue to the state rather than a decrease, or at least marginally. But at the very least, you help build an Oregon industry, you help create a few jobs throughout the state. So it's a good at base. It's not a bad economic development strategy. It makes a lot of sense. And probably bottom line, within the broader industry, you're actually creating fairness. You can ask the question of why should these people not get the same kind of treatment or similar treatment as the people in the wine industry, the craft beer industry, or the cider industry. It's just fair. With that, I'll stop. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when a bottle is sold at the tasting room, the OLCC takes the same amount as if it were sold out of one of our stores. Is that correct?
Currently, that's true. That would not be true if you pass this bill on the first $250,000 of sales. But anything after that, it'd still be the same.
But they do take their 5%.
They do get the 5%, and that was an arrangement we worked out that would cover their administrative cost.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, briefly, may I add one other thing? These distillers are using ingredients that are grown on Oregon farms as well. So there is a connection. It's all local, and it's driving the business, which we need to make sure that we're looking at sustainability.
Good point. Thank you. Thank you,
Senator. I have to go and testify. I didn't want to think that our folks here testifying as being rude. So I will be back in about 10 minutes.
Thank you, James. Thank you. Any other questions?
Great. Thank you, sir.
Huh?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Appreciate it.
So we just lost our quorum.
Uh-oh. Sorry.
So we're going to take a
pause for a few minutes and until we get to gain our quorum.
Yeah, we're not in an information, so we can't.
We need to do that?
We have to because we're in a public hearing, not information.
Mr. Allenack?
It's a public hearing. We don't need a quorum.
Oh.
We don't need a quorum.
We don't need a quorum. Never mind.
Not for a public
Please
hearing.
Be seated.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. I misspoke. We don't need a quorum for a public hearing, so we're going to continue on.
Oh, great.
So...
Mr. Molitor.
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity here. I love hearing the support. And like I say, given the opportunity here, I'm Rick Molitor. I'm the owner, operating manager of New Basin Distilling. Brad Irwin and I are somewhat neighbors. I'm in Madras. He's down in Bend. He talked about tasting rooms and talked about, you heard a lot about the compensation strategy and where we're at. My former life was an educator, so I love informing people and teaching people about new opportunities, new things, and what you're hearing today is very much in line with what we're asking for. And I say we, I appreciate Brad's work with the Distillers Guild because we're together as a team trying to bring some support so we can be known like we have the industry here in Oregon for beer and wine. So you had heard about the compensation piece. I do have a small tasting room on Highway 26. A lot of people will swing by, about 95% are on their way to Bend or on their way back to Portland. They'll swing in, and I love being able to share and tell our story about distilleries. I'm a true farm to spirit distiller. We actually grow our own grain. I'm able to point out the window of my tasting room and show the field of the Oregon certified rye that we grow. As you heard, most people will buy a bottle. Every Monday, I religiously fill out my OLCC report, and I send my 33% tax or fee to OLCC. For me, that averages about $750 a week that I send to OLCC.
Do you want to take a break?
Acknowledge, Senator Haas. All right. And those funds really would be used to redirect to growing more grain, hiring additional support, potentially looking at additional tasting room opportunities for new basin distilling. Those funds, I wouldn't say aren't, I'd say they're vital. They're vital for my company's survival and for us to be able to thrive and create an opportunity. And as I said, teach and tell people about our story, what we do, what's special about Oregon, what's special about our product. It's something that we desperately could use. So I appreciate your support and help, and any questions?
Thank you. Apologize for being a little late. There was some traffic out there. Senator Byer, have you already gone?
Yes.
So where are we on this list?
I did the check mark.
Okay. So we have Erica Duggins and Tom Burlow.
Committee members, thank you for hearing testimony today. My name is Erica Deegans, and my husband and I, who's in the audience, own Stone Barn Brandy Works in Portland, Oregon. 10 years ago, we were excited by the idea of producing quality spirits. We had a love for Oregon produce and wanted to embark on a new venture together, starting with 100 pounds of frozen plums and a custom-made German pot still. We made brandy. We have been proud to grow the business, develop our portfolio, and support local agriculture. We source quince from Wilsonville, pears and apples from Salem, grain from Junction City and Milton Friedwater, cranberries from Sixes, plums and prunes from Dayton, malted grain from Madras, apricots from Kimberly, walnuts from Newburgh, housecap berries from Hillsboro, and grapes from all over the state. Much of what we produce are limited small batches, which we only sell through our tasting room. If we didn't have the ability to do production work during tasting room hours because our two spaces are connected, we would have shut our tasting room years ago. But 10 years in, our tasting room still does not support itself, and we are faced with shortening our hours, which would be a terrible pity because personal contact with customers has great value. My husband, myself, and our full-time employee, Andy Garrison, strive to create an experience for visitors. We tour our production area and talk about how we make whiskey, what a hydrometer is, different types of barrels, whatever is of interest to our guests. This opportunity to try local spirits right where they are made, I would say, is pretty special. We see people who live in the area, and we also get a high percentage of tourists. Over the past months, we've hosted people from Texas, California, New York, Washington, and Japan who are excited to see where and how things are made and taste spirits that are unique to Oregon. Passage of Bill 1565 would allow us to retain more of our earnings. We could hire additional tasting room staff. We would grow partnerships with farms and orchards, mills and grain growers in Oregon. It would enable us to test markets in our tasting room for new spirits that use local ingredients. More resources would allow us and give us an incentive to improve and expand our tasting room and increase its visibility and continue to offer an authentic Oregon experience. Thank you for your work and your leadership.
Thank you for your testimony. Your voice is carrying through the microphone, so sorry about this. It's coming through just fine.
So, Mr. Chair, if we tell him that someone that we're talking about whiskey, he might not honk so loud.
Yeah.
Chairman Haas and committee, thank you for having me here. My name is Tom Berklow. I'm vice president of the Oregon Distillers Guild, also the owner and founder of New Deal Distillery in Portland. And we're considered one of the more established distilleries. We started in 2004. And when I started, someone told me, if you're going to start a business, get a job. So even though I have over 10 full-time employees, multiple part-time employees, I still work a side job because this business is about accumulating capital and resources. And I think everybody in the room, and I know there's other distillers here that would want to speak today and probably won't because they don't have, we don't have the time. But every one of the distillers that I've met have put, you know, personal resources, debt into building these businesses. And, you know, it's a, when you think about the tasting room, it is a primary marketing tool. But if you're someone like Cannon Beach, which recently closed down, and your business is completely out of the tasting room and 33% of your gross revenue goes to the state when you're in the startup phase, I mean, there's really no way to run a viable business in that manner. So kind of like the brewers and the winemakers before us, we just want a way to start the long journey of accumulating the capital we're going to need to perhaps build a whiskey in, a whiskey industry in Oregon, which hasn't existed, and it's still going to take a half a generation to grow to that. So we're only halfway on our journey, and we feel like the tasting room is a key element to help us grow there. It's marketing. Travel Oregon sends people to us, but just like Erica said, I was like the eighth largest tasting room 2 years ago, and I'm closing my hours down because I'm like, well, this is not profitable. There's no operating profit out of the tasting room because of the 33% revenue. So my goal and my hope is, you know, Oregon will make world-class spirits. Like Clear Creek, we have an award-winning brandy, double gold, best of class. I know other people have won multiple awards. Cannon Beach was closed down, was very award-winning. So the quality is there. We just need a rational policy for our tasting room so we can get past the startup phase and compete nationally. So thank you for your time.
I appreciate your attitude of having a job if you want to start a business. I know that feeling. Yeah, that's right. If you're going to do it, you do it.
All right. Thank you both.
Representative Nos is here. Representative, did you want to weigh in on this bill?
Just for a moment.
Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rob Nos. I'm the state representative for House District 42. And in my first term, I found out that I was also the distinguished representative for the Distillery Row District, which is basically an area of my district where a lot of these businesses that Tom was just talking about sort of operate. And over the course of a couple of years, many of them have gone out of business or moved away and not been able to make a go of it. And a lot of them believe it's because of the cost, that it's just not very cost effective to operate a tasting room. And the tasting room is probably one of the best vehicles that these distilleries have to be able to sort of reveal their products to the public and then get them to try things. And then once they see them in their local liquor store, then they're able to purchase them there after they've tried them. And so normally it's not my habit to get in front of a tax committee and recommend a reduction in taxes. It's a little bit against my brand. But I think in this instance, I believe that if we can make a tasting room a little bit more economically viable in the long run, we facilitate the ability to have these products move and have Oregon receive taxes from these products at a higher rate. Short-term loss, long-term gain. That's what I'm hoping.
All right. Thank you, Representative. Appreciate you coming by and weighing in on this. I'm going to bring up three people here, Jody Weiser, Mark Garst, and Mike Marshall. We don't have proper paperwork to send us the license. We have a fiscal light.
Right.
So we don't have proper paperwork.
You can go ahead.
So that's what we're waiting for.
Uh,
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the League of Oregon Cities. So there will be two concepts that will happen this session around the notion of liquor agent compensation. At roughly $80 million per year, revenue from the sale of alcohol is the second largest source of state shared revenue for the cities, just behind the Highway Trust Fund. Of that $80 million, about 93% of that money is made up from the sale of distilled spirits. So this topic's obviously of quite a bit of interest to the cities. We're uncertain of what the total revenue hit between the two would be, but I think that we're looking at in the range of $15 to $20 million per biennium, and that much smaller portion of that will be from this bill that's before you today. The League of Oregon Cities supports small businesses. We value small businesses, and we don't just say that. We show it through property tax exemptions and that type of thing. We have an enterprise zone program that I know that at least one of the distilleries has availed themselves of. So, we put our money where our mouth is. The notion that the state would decrease money going to the cities in order to increase agent compensation is a little hard for us. We have public safety costs that are significant that are related to alcohol. And, we did a 2011 study, and at that time, and that was some time ago, the amount of money coming in to cities and counties was about the alcohol-related cost to cities and counties was about $109 million, and the revenue that was coming in was about $74 million. So it didn't quite cover its costs. We're gonna be doing a refresh of that study going into the 2021 session, so this might be something to put a pin in, something that we're gonna think about down the road. But I don't know that it's an issue that we can make up on volume as far as sales go. As you increase sales, you'll increase the public safety costs, and I don't know that it will work out that we'll see more money just by more sales or when you consider in relative costs. So Senate Bill 1565 is before you. I think that Senator Byers did a terrific job of explaining what it does. It increases the agent compensation from 17% to 45% of retail for bottles that are sold out of tasting rooms. OLCC has estimated a reduced revenue of $3.5 million per biennium, and we'll be interested to see what the Legislative Revenue Office comes up with. If you kind of just do the math, what we're talking about, if they were doing the 250,000 in sales, we think that about 70,000 per tasting room would be the tax savings that they would be able to realize, the maximum tax savings. And that works out for 100 tasting rooms to about $14 million a biennium. Now, the revenue estimate's a lot lower than that, and I think that that's reflecting the fact that most of these tasting rooms aren't doing anywhere near $250,000 in retail sales. But I just want to point out that if this bill's successful and we see more sales at tasting rooms, the revenue hit to cities would grow. Because these bottles don't go through OLCC warehouses, I can understand the point of the bill proponents. The cost to the state in terms of handling those bottles is much lower, but the cost to cities is not. Our public safety costs are not tied to whether or not OLCC has to touch the bottles. So I know that this is not before you, but I think it's important context. There's another conversation happening down the hall in Ways and Means, and that would deal with agent compensation at liquor stores. That's really probably where the league has more of a concern. That will have a higher revenue impact, where it's estimated at about $13.4 million per biennium right now by OLCC. And again, that number would grow as sales grow. Compensation was just increased in 2019 by $3 million. So this is kind of an ongoing conversation. The League of Cities is not opposed to increasing the amount of money that folks realize on sales out of tasting rooms. We do not have any concern with that side of the equation. Our concern is strictly limited to where that revenue comes from. So how could we get this money to these tasting rooms and not negatively impact city and county budgets? We could increase the markup on bottles. I think that would be unpopular with a lot of your manufacturers. There's currently a 50 cent per bottle surcharge. We could increase that surcharge slightly, and we could divert that money to agent compensation. But I think that the league's preferred method would be just to simply adjust the distribution formula for these revenues. Currently, the league gets about 34%, and we would want the economists to look at the number. But I think that by increasing it by 1.2%, you would be able to cover both the tasting room bill and the conversation that's happening in Ways and Means. So we're working right now with a member on an amendment that would do just that. I don't think that you guys have to have that amendment before you move the bill. I think that that amendment could probably be addressed in Ways and Means. If you want to maintain some control over this thing, that's up to you. But that's where we're at. Again, I just have to say, I mean, personally, I love these tasting rooms. I've been to them. I've done economic development tours at them. Great business. And we love all Oregon businesses, you know, always try and buy them. They make a great gift when you're at the liquor store. They're right there on the shelf. They get a good bit of shelf space. I think they're 17% maybe of the sales currently. I'm sorry, 13% is some 2018 numbers from OLCC of the sales out of our liquor store. So, you know, it's a great idea to encourage this business. We don't have a problem with that. We're just worried about how it gets paid for. We don't want to pay for 34% of it. So that's my testimony.
Mark, you seem to have an extremely good knowledge of the spirits business. It kind of worries me a little bit. Thank you. Jody.
Chair Hess and members of the committee, I'm Jody Weiser, speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. According to the testimony from the industry, the purpose of this legislation is to make tasting rooms and therefore their businesses, because that's the primary place they get their first customers, economically viable. But why is the solution to their business model the public purse? They collect taxes, but it's not their gross. The CAT is not applied to those taxes they collect. That's taxes that they have collected from customers. It's customers' taxes that would be being returned to them. Are these business owners negotiating their rent, their insurance, their materials and equipment or utilities because they're not economically viable, or is this the only cost that they're asking to have changed? They entered the business knowing that this was what it is. So does it make sense for us to say, oh, wait, you're having trouble, we will adjust it? 1565 asks that the public subsidize their businesses by returning to them all but 5% of the taxes that are correctly collected from their customers who purchase these alcoholic beverages. The same tax that is paid on alcohol consumed at every bar and restaurant or purchased at every OLCC store. And the bottles that are purchased and tasting rooms are not going to cause fewer social problems and fewer financial costs to the state than the bottles that are bought at OLCC stores or the alcohol that is purchased at restaurants and bars. So we're basically taking money that is used for treatment and for public safety and removing it, even though we know this is a product that causes problems. It has higher health, higher cost to society than most any other product. The bill would hand any distillery with one or more tasting room and sales of $250,000, $112,500 in subsidy. Would take it from county, cities, and the general fund, $112,500. That's more than we pay for a teacher to work much longer days than any of these tasting rooms operate. So that's a fairly high amount. They currently get all but 70,000 of that. They already get subsidy for selling it, just like the liquor stores get subsidy for selling or get reimbursed for selling. It's not a subsidy then, Kate. That's just how we pay them for selling the liquor that they sell. So they're getting what other sellers get. The restaurants and bars don't get anything for selling the substance. So we're really treating this one group of about 100 businesses very differently from how we would treat everybody else. Clear Creek Distillery started in 1985. A couple years later, they came to the legislature and asked to be able to have tasting rooms and sell liquor. They and other distillers have succeeded without this subsidy. And their tasting room in Portland is now open 6 days a week. The problem may be that there are simply too many of these businesses for the market to sustain. A number of them have already gone out of business. That's what usually happens when there's oversupply of a business thing. It's not that the public comes in and subsidizes the business. When bookstores started suffering, and most of them have disappeared, we didn't come up with a plan to give them $112,500 for every 20 out of every $250,000 they sold. We're doing something for this industry we simply don't do for other industries. You have heard that beer and wine being poorly taxed is a rationale for changing how we tax distilled liquor. If, in fact, your goal is to support an emerging industry, then why haven't we ended the low taxes for beer and wine? Then we would have the money to use to help out this new, but not so new industry, since it's actually started in 1985 in this state, legally, in any case. And so we just don't see why this industry is getting treated so much differently than other industries. The solutions proposed by the League of Oregon Cities are other solutions where the costs are coming from the consumers rather than from the public make way better sense. And we support the idea of giving this bill continued thought. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Mike Marshall, and I have the honor and privilege of serving as the executive director of Oregon Recovers, which is a statewide coalition, of healthcare companies, treatment providers, recovery leaders, and certified alcohol and drug counselors. I'm also a person in long-term recovery. I just celebrated 12 years last week, free from alcohol and drugs. And I'm here to be the real wet blanket. I very much appreciate Senator Beyer and Representative Nose, but this is just a terrible public policy idea. The governor declared addiction a public health crisis 2 years ago, and she did that because we have the third highest untreated addiction rate in the country. It climbed from fourth to third last year, and we rank almost dead last in access to treatment. And the net result of that is that five people die each day in alcohol-related deaths, five. So four of you plus one today, tomorrow another five, the day after that another five. The combined total of which is almost 2,000 people. At the height of the AIDS epidemic in 1994, we lost 362 people. So that's about a 600 to 700% increase over the worst year of an international epidemic. We don't think of addiction or alcohol in that context, but we need to, and we need to begin to orient Oregon towards that. That fatality rate has increased 33% since the year 2000. And what has happened since the year 2000? We have invested all kinds of public resources and support for the craft beer industry, for the wine industry, for the distilleries, now for cannabis. And while we've done so, we've starved our treatment system. We're last in access to treatment. Wait times to get into treatment, as I think you probably all know from friends and family, are 3 or 4 weeks. The same federal report that came out and that ranked us as having the third highest addiction rate said that, you know, we also have one of the worst mental health rates in the country, but 70 to 80% of folks with a mental health problem receive some level of treatment or care in Oregon. Whether it's adequate, whether it's sufficient, that's debatable. But less than 8% of Oregonians, your constituents with a substance use disorder, receive any level of treatment or care. Less than 8%. And so currently the system is that amongst many other things, amongst many other ways, and not the least of which is through charity, our treatment system as it exists today is funded significantly by the OLCC. I think 40% of their revenue is supposed to go into addiction treatment issues, if I have that right. Now, any amount of money you take out of there to put into making private distilleries more profitable means fewer people are going to have access to treatment. Fewer of your constituents are going to have access to treatment. The total amount of money may not be huge, but remember that the people treating your friends and family members with addiction, if they're getting the treatment, are peers and certified alcohol and drug counselors. They're the least paid in the healthcare system. So $13 to $15 an hour is a peer mentor rate, and upwards of $19 to $22 an hour for a certified alcohol and drug counselor. So any amount of money that you take out of the OLCC that they are not then directing into the treatment system means fewer certified alcohol and drug counselors, fewer peer mentors, which means fewer people in recovery. And we know that if we make an investment in recovery, according to the Surgeon General, if we put public resources into a treatment system that's effective, we reduce the, and we keep someone in recovery for 5 years, we reduce the relapse rate down to 15%. There's no other chronic health condition or public health challenge where you can make that level of investment and see that return on investment. But we're not doing that in Oregon. And we have to do that. And so any piece of legislation that takes money out of the treatment system and promotes the alcohol industry is the complete opposite direction of where Oregon needs to go in order to address this crisis that is affecting not just the friends and families, the five people who are dying each day, or the 400,000 Oregonians tonight who are struggling with a substance use disorder. But think about the legislation you're considering relative to our foster care system, which is overwhelmed because 67 to 70% of the kids in that system are there because of a parent's untreated addiction, primarily from alcohol. Or we have the third highest youth incarceration rate, and those young men at McLaren will tell you that three quarters of them will tell you that they were drunk or high when they committed the crime that they are incarcerated for, and the same level will tell you they come from multi-generational addiction, primarily alcohol. So we have to begin to turn this corner away from promoting alcohol at the expense of the people of Oregon, and certainly not until we have a robust continuum of care that makes sure that we significantly reduce that untreated addiction rate and dramatically increase the recovery rate. And we're only going to do that by putting more money into the system, not taking money away and putting it into private alcohol industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate that. All right, thank you, all three. I'm looking at the clock here. I know we have one more witness, Jason.
Chair Haas, thank you for allowing me to talk. For the record, my name is Jason Greenwood. I'm the owner of Salem's only distillery, Divine Distillers, and I'm planning on talking, but several points that came up that I would like to address. I want to point out that we own a distillery here in Salem. We have a tasting room, a small tasting room, and we have several employees that we would have hired more of if this bill had passed or is to pass. 95% of the money that we would get from this bill would go to hiring staff, not anything else. The reason for this bill is for us, the entirety of that money would go towards hiring staff. I currently am able to survive as a distiller, yes, but I'm not able to have a tasting room because of this bill. We have a tasting room that is virtually closed right now. And the reason why it's virtually closed is it does not make money. If this bill is passed, we would have the entirety of the money that of the difference would be going to hiring people, employing people. Of our 54 products that we have in production right now, 52 of them are sourced in Oregon. Only two of them are sold in liquor stores right now, without special handling, without special requests from people. Those special requests come only from the fact that we have a tasting room and people have tried them. That is the only reason why they get moved anywhere. We don't have the money, like Absolute, to say, please take our stuff, we'll pay for it. The only way that people even hear about 52 of our products is because of our tasting room. I also want to add and address the fact that this money that we're talking about is only money from transportation costs that OLCC is not having to deal with for these products. So we're not talking about taking money away from anyone. We're just talking about money that would be normally spent on transportation. And finally, I would like to just touch base on something that the gentleman that was just talking about, which is addiction and support of our local community. We currently employ 3 addicts, 2 people that were homeless before they worked for us. We give a lot of money to several treatment facilities. Addiction is really important to me. I was an addict, not for alcohol. And the fact that we support addiction and treatment centers is very important to me. It's very important to my wife. And we do not take money from addiction support centers. We give it. And we hire people who are homeless, and we hire people who do not have another form of making money. We also hire two of our employees have foster children, and those people have money, have a home because of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, that's our witness list here. I'm gonna close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1565. We do not have paperwork to bring this to a vote yet, so we will put that off until maybe tomorrow or as soon as we get the proper paperwork. We do have paperwork on 1528, and so with your indulgence, committee, I'd like to move that to the floor and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1528. This is the Rolling Reconnect Bill. We heard this the other day, had the accountants come in. It's an annual bill that we do every year. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's harder. This one, for now, is an easy one. So let's make hay while the sun shines and the horns blare. Senator Findley, do you want to make a motion?
Thank you, Chair Hass. I move we adopt the dash 3 for Senate Bill 1528.
It's
dated 2/5/20.
Senator Findley moves the dash 3s in Senate Bill 1565. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, Senate Bill 1565 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass.
Did I say 5?
Oh. All right.
8.
Let's withdraw that motion, and let's correct the bill number. And let's go back to Senator Findley.
I apologize, Chair Hass. I make a motion that we move Senate Bill 1528-3 to adoption.
Okay. Senator Findley moves the dash 3s on Senate Bill 1528. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
So, now the bill. Chair Hess, I recommend that we move Senate Bill 1528 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Findley moves Senate Bill 1528 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 1528 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. And Senator Findley, would you like to carry this bill?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, sorry
to screw
you up
there. Right number.
All right, let's at least get started on the next issue, which is the scintillating technical fix general revenue bill. And I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1531. I guess the best way to do this would just be go through them all. And we do have some people who want to testify, but let's go through them all first, section by section.
Okay, good morning, Mr.
See how far we get by 10 o'clock.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1531, as you mentioned, this is the omnibus bill before you. We do have right now the dash 2, the dash 3, and the dash 5 amendments. And there's still some ongoing discussion on other amendments as well, maybe some language tweaking in what you have in the dash 5. So the dash 5 is a gut and stuff, so that's got most of the contents are in there, and the dash 2 and 3 are standalone. There is a document in OLIS titled 1528 Section Contents that describes the contents of the dash 5 amendment, and then also has the dash 2 and the dash 3. So I can really briefly hit what each section is.
I think that makes the most sense.
Okay. So sections 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 of the bill both start off with property tax exemptions. Both are related to low-income property tax exemptions. So we have the nonprofit low-income rental housing and then the low-income rental property housing. And so the theme of these two changes, I suppose, are the first one is responding to federal changes to the low-income housing tax credit related to the income parameters for folks that are in this housing. So taking into account the changes at the federal level and bringing them into Oregon's property tax exemptions. And the second change has to do with really it's aligning or using language from the nonprofit low-income rental housing property tax exemption and putting that into the low-income rental property tax exemption related to the income of the individuals that are in this property. And again, there's limits of 60% of area median income for defining low income and then up to 80%. So that's really the two changes there. I know there'll be testimony in more detail on that. Sections 5 and 6 is just a change to an existing property tax exemption for environmentally sensitive logging equipment, and it's just adding the held for use language, in this case allowing someone who has this property and for whatever reason didn't use it in that year for environmentally sensitive logging or for any other purpose. But so if they didn't use it, this would allow them to still get the exemption on that property. Section 7 to 10, again, another property tax exemption, this one related to single unit housing, and it's just making a modification to allow a city that's overseeing this to extend the deadline for construction completion from right now. We have a 12-month extension that's allowed. It allow for up to 24 months, and there's also some statutory cleanup language in there as well. There were some dates that were stepping on each other, so we made those changes.
Kyle, just to interrupt, on those property tax exemptions, the first four, we're talking about no revenue loss or gains, correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we're looking at minimal type of things here. Yeah, so they're changes on the edges, and they're pretty, for the changes, they try to stay confined when we're linking up with the federal level as well.
Yeah. Go ahead. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair House. Can you just clarify, you mentioned the one about the extension from the 12 to the 24 months for the construction. What's the background on that?
Yeah, Senator Taylor, and I know testimony from the city of Portland as well, but part of that was it set up where you can receive the exemption on the property, and the exemption would be, I believe it's for 10 years, but there's a window to construct the property from when you get the application, and there was a few instances, I believe the example is for Habitat for Humanity, that in some cases they'll acquire multiple properties and then try to build them all at once, but they might acquire them in maybe more of a staggered sense, and they're having some difficulty in meeting the within the 12-month extension right now. So it'd be giving it an additional 12 months, so a full 2 years, to try to give them a little more opportunity to build those properties out per the parameters of the exemption.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair Hess. But is this only apply to organizations such as Habitat for Humanity or Low Income Housing or something, or is this just across the board?
The changes to statute, Senator, would be, it's the change to the statute across the board. There are additional, I guess you could describe them as, it would be a city that oversees this program, so they have kind of additional requirements that have to be met. So it is that the statute itself is kind of the guiding principle, and the city sometimes will set up their own program that can have more sideboards, if you will, on it to rein this in. But this change, yes, it would be to the statute as a whole, not specific to the case.
Yeah. Yeah, a follow-up, Chair Haas. So, I mean, the concern I have with that is that we already have, we have so much redevelopment happening in my district, and I have quite a few constituents who complain about when some of the housing developers come in and they are building a large-scale developer, maybe have, you know, I'll make up a number, but 10 or 20 houses being built in an area, and they're kind of moving around, and they unfortunately don't get built as quickly as they could otherwise. I just want to make certain that we're not giving, you know, license to folks to, you know, you have 2 years to finish constructing a single family house. That's rather, it's a pretty big inconvenience if you're living next door to that. It's one thing if it's being applied for special circumstances like Habitat for Humanity or low income housing, but I don't know. I just, you can look into that a little bit further, please. I'd like to hear what the testimony is, though, why we would do that across the board, but okay.
So moving on to section 11, it's just, this is a slight modification to refund interest, and there was this following up on an errant on that was inserted into statute a couple sessions ago, so it'd be making, just taking that on back out, deleting it essentially. Sections 12, 13, and 14, the theme here of the changes is this relates to a tax credit that's available for contributions to, for the IDA, the Individual Development Account Program, and then also the auction tax credits for film and video and opportunity grant. And the idea with the changes here is really about trying to line up or more closely bring together the point at which someone would receive the credit for the contribution they made or the auction, the credit that they purchase at auction, when they receive that credit and when they can then claim it on their return. So it's trying to shorten that date of, say, someone who purchases a credit in, say, July of 2020, right now is going to be waiting until they file their return the following year. And the idea here would be to make the change where you could purchase this credit before you file your extension return, or if you made the IDA contribution in, say, February of 2020, then you could then file that as if you made that contribution during the 2019 tax year. And it's just trying to shorten that period between when you make that action that would earn the credit for you, and then when you receive that specific benefit, I suppose, of when you file your taxes. Sections 15, 17, and 18 have to do with clarifications to the Shortline Railroad credit that was enacted last session. Section 16 is just effective dates. Section 19 is corporate excise tax, and this is just pointing to the Internal Revenue Code. There is a modification of the Internal Revenue Code, so we're pointing to the wrong spot. So it's not making a change, it's just pointing us to the spot that where the change has been made at the federal level. And then lastly, we get to the amendments, the dash 2 and the dash 3. Both are related to the special use fuel license fee. This is for vehicles of natural gas and propane. And the first, the dash 2, the change there, or the specification being made here, is that the special use fuel license fee, it would make that not subject to the 6-year implicit sunset that's on the books that this committee's heard about related to things that are deemed tax expenditures. So I'd say that 6-year implicit sunset does not exist for the special use fuel license fee. And then the dash 3 is just requiring Oregon Department of Transportation and the Oregon Transportation Commission to biannually review the special use fuel license fees and then recommend to the interim committee on transportation any adjustment to those fees that are deemed appropriate going forward.
Okay, pretty glamorous stuff there. And we do have one or two amendments that are maybe in the pipeline that haven't been added yet. But they fall into this category of technical fixes, non-controversial, and no effect on revenues. So let's call up a few people with the time we have left. I'll start with Allison McIntosh and Gwen Baldwin.
Okay.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Finley, members of the committee, my name is Allison McIntosh. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance, and we wanted to express our support for the provisions related to affordable housing and affordable homeownership included in Senate Bill 1531 and its Dash 5 amendments. The Housing Alliance is a coalition of about 90 organizations from all parts of the state, and we believe everyone deserves a safe, stable, and affordable place to call home. I want to talk primarily about the sections 1 through 4, the local option affordable housing property tax exemptions. Over the years, as you know, the legislature has authorized several property tax exemptions for affordable housing, including ORS 307-515 and 307-540. Local option property tax exemptions are one tool local jurisdictions can use to incentivize and make financially viable affordable housing developments in their community. And communities across the state have adopted these local option property tax exemptions to help ensure that affordable housing is part of our communities. So as Kyle mentioned, recently the federal government made a change that will allow more people of different income levels to be served by affordable housing. The policy adopted by the federal government only impacts the federal low-income housing tax credit, which is one of our main tools to develop affordable housing in our communities. The policy is called income averaging, and it allows a development to serve people with slightly higher incomes, up to 80% of area median income, if the property also serves people with lower incomes, and the average income served by the property is 60% of area median income. The change is really critical. We have the largest need for affordable housing for people with the lower incomes, seniors, people with disabilities, people earning fixed incomes. And so this will allow us to serve more of those folks in affordable housing developments today. Oregon Housing and Community Services has already begun to implement the income averaging policy, and we need our local option property tax exemptions included in 307, 515, and 540 to align with these new criteria. The language included in the Dash 5 amendments would raise the income limits served by these exemptions from 60% of area median income to 80% to align with these new federal definitions, if and only if the project is using the new federal flexibility. It would also allow local jurisdictions to have choice and flexibility about whether to allow that in their community. So we would urge your support for those provisions, and we have noted for Kyle that there is some very minor changes that need to address some language tweaks. He has a list. I also wanted to note our support for the provisions included in Section 7 through 10 of the Dash 5 amendments related to the single unit exemption or the homeownership limited tax exemption. That policy allows us to develop affordable homeownership options for people with low incomes and gives them a small property tax exemption. And I know that the City of Portland is going to be up here soon after I am to answer all of your very detailed questions about that policy. So thank you so much for your time today.
Housing questions? Okay.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Finley, and members of the committee, Gwen Baldwin here today representing the City of Beaverton. Beaverton supports the language in Senate Bill 1531-5, sections 1 through 4, related to income averaging. For certain projects, the benefit from local property tax exemptions as a way to make the most of the affordable housing being created through the local property tax exemption and federal low-income housing tax credits. Under ORS 307.540, Beaverton passed an ordinance that allowed qualified nonprofit affordable housing providers 100% property tax exemption on land where they intend to develop affordable rental housing, are actively or have developed affordable rental housing. We appreciate our affordable housing partners and work with them and others to develop affordable housing in all parts of Beaverton. Senate Bill 1531 is one way the state can help facilitate our collective work by aligning the affordability requirements of the local tax exemption programs with those federal low-income housing tax credit rules, making financing and long-term operation of affordable projects more viable, more sustainable for more persons at all levels of low to very low income. Beaverton urges your support of Senate Bill 1531-5 and the income averaging language it contains. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Both. I want to get the City of Portland up here. So Eric, Thomas, Jessica, you all want to come up or one? Yeah.
Good
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll with the City of Portland. Thank you for taking the time to hear testimony from my colleagues and I in support of two separate amendments to Senate Bill 1531, one of which has already been referenced and is included in the Dash 5 amendment. The other is in the queue. The two amendments are first, seeking authorization to allow the City of Portland Revenue Division to request background checks from the Oregon State Police to maintain compliance with federal guidelines and ensure our ability to effectively administer the tax code for the City of Portland and Multnomah County. The second is a technical fix to the Home Buyer Opportunity Limited Tax Exemption, or the HOLTE program, in ORS 307-651, sections 7 through 10 of the Dash 5. For the sake of time, I will turn it over to my colleagues, recognizing that the fact patterns leading to the development of both of these requests this session are detailed, and so I'm happy to spend time after the hearing in the coming days following up with individual offices if there are lingering questions.
I think that might be perfect. Thanks.
So with that, I'll turn it over to Thomas Lanham, the director of our Revenue Division at the City of Portland.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Thomas Lanham. I'm the director of the City of Portland's Revenue Division. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of an amendment to SB 1531. The Revenue Division of the City of Portland collects over $600 million each year for the City of Portland and partner jurisdictions such as Multnomah County. Like other tax collection agencies, the Revenue Division uses federal taxpayer information from the U.S. Internal Revenue Service to confirm compliance with our tax codes. Using this information is critical to our ability to identify and contact non-compliant taxpayers and ultimately collect revenues in support of a wide range of programs, including law enforcement, fire protection, parks, schools, and homeless and health services, among many others. The IRS has numerous requirements governing the use and protection of federal taxpayer information. One requirement that was strengthened in 2016 following the Revenue Division's receipt of federal taxpayer information is the addition of a background investigation minimum requirement for tax agency staff who have access to federal taxpayer information. Specifically, tax agency staff background checks are required to include a federal fingerprint check. The FBI has informed the city through the Oregon State Police and Portland Police Bureau that they will conduct checks for those agencies with state-level legislative authority, and we do not currently have that authority. We ask for the amendment before you today to narrowly include municipalities with a population of over 250,000 or more in the definition of authorized agency in ORS 181A.195. This will allow us to get the background checks we need to comply with IRS regulations and continue collecting revenue in support of a range of critical local programs. The City of Portland respectfully requests your support for this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. And we don't have that amendment yet. It's in the works, but there's no information on it.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Connor, Senior Policy and Planning Coordinator for the Housing Bureau for the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Section 7 through 10 in the Dash 5 Amendment to Senate Bill 1531. The Home Buyer Opportunity Limited Tax Exemption, the HOLTE program, is an affordable homeownership tool to stimulate the construction of new single-unit housing and encourage homeownership among low and moderate-income families. In Portland, the HOLTE program allows the city to forego property tax revenues in order to incentivize these affordable opportunities. The City of Portland is seeking a technical fix to the HOLTE to allow the city to grant an extension to the construction timeframe for newly constructed single-unit housing up to 24 months if the applicant can document progress with construction. Currently, projects must be fully constructed upon sale and sold within 2 years of final permit or certificate of occupancy, whichever is first. This time frame has unintended consequences for nonprofit home builders, such as Habitat for Humanity, that often request that a group of exemption applications for a development be processed at the same time in one batch, rather than individually to save resources. This can put units at risk of not being built within the two-year timeframe. Currently, two projects have already lost their ability to participate in this program, and up to 20 more are at risk. The program benefit is a 10-year property tax exemption to the low-income home buyer on the structural improvements of the single-unit housing as long as the home and the owner remain program eligible. Should be noted that owners are still responsible for paying any taxes on the assessed value of the land during this time. The program incentivizes the development of family-size housing with a program requirement of 2 or 3 bedrooms. We also operate the program with income limits. Home buyers cannot earn more than 100% of the median family income for our area for a family of 4. That is currently at $87,900 for the Portland area. On average, our program participants in 2019 actually made around $55,000. When the exemption expires, the property will be fully assessed, and the homeowner will begin paying the full property taxes. The Bureau supports the homeowners starting about 2 years in advance of the expiration date. We begin sending letters, continuing to make the homeowner aware of the expiration date and to encourage them to begin saving for their higher property taxes. This request is a small change with a really big impact for dozens of new first-time low-income home buyers, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Tim Williams.
Thank you, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Finley, members of the committee. My name is Tim Williams. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Film. I wanted to speak specifically to Section 13 of the -5 Amendment for SB 1531, specifically those changes that revolve around the Oregon Production Investment Fund, or OPIF. As some of you already know, the OPIF program is a program that we use to both retain and attract production here in the state. It is funded through an online tax credit auction every year. That tax credit auction was impacted by the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act, and we've made some adjustments to it over the last couple of sessions, which have helped immensely in making the program more viable. Thank you for that. This change allows us, as Kyle mentioned, to have a tax credit that is purchased during a current year also be applicable to a prior year. This will allow us to market to people who have extended their tax filing dates into the next year so that we can broaden our market a little bit more. For example, if we do an auction in September, the tax credit that is bought in September of 2019 can also be used on the people's 2018 returns if they've extended their filing application to October. Just by way of example, the OPIF program has tracked more than $280 million of direct spending in the last biennium, and that impacts about 8,000 jobs during that two-year period, and it has been in existence since 2005. Thank you.
Questions on the film tax credit? Thank you, Tim. Lana Butterfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield of the Pacific Propane Gas Association. And I know we have one member of this committee who is a big propane user and another member who lives in a district where propane is an important fuel. Propane is a very versatile fuel, but when it's used as a motor vehicle fuel, the point of tax collection is at the point of sale. And that means that many resellers who sell propane generally will not sell to motor vehicles because they don't want the burden of collecting the tax. And that means it limits the places where if you have a fleet, for example, you can buy the fuel. So association passed a law some years ago that set up the fuel decal program, and this places the point of collection at year where ODOT collects the tax, and they put together this financial formula for figuring out how much that would be. And then the fleet person can buy the fuel at any location, and you know, there's no problem with getting the fuel. Last session, I saw a bill on the docket, and I was puzzled by it because it extended the program. I didn't realize that the decal program was considered a tax expenditure, but I lobbied it in the House. And when it came to the Senate the night before the hearing, my molar split, and I was in a great deal of pain. And that morning, I ended up in the emergency room of the hospital, and later, you know, in emergency surgery. And because no one was there to speak for the bill, he didn't pass it. Chair Haas was very gracious in saying he'd give it another hearing, but then it became a casualty of the Republican walkout. So, you know,
he wasn't here.
I wasn't here.
As a good lobbyist, I tried to, you know, puzzle out what I should do next, and so I relied on several of your staff people, and they made some suggestions. I'm considering Amendment 3 to be the Mazen Malik Amendment, and Amendment 2 to be the Chris Allenect Amendment. Mazen said, and I approached him first because he was very helpful to me when I lobbied the bill through the House. He said, this, you know, the fuel decal program is not a tax expenditure. It's simply another way to collect tax. And, you're not asking for any money. So why don't you think about a different method that instead of going through the legislature, you'd have ODOT collect the tax like the log truckers do. When I talked to Chris some months later, he said, well, there might be a simpler approach, and that is to amend a bill just simply to say that this program does not fall under the law that talks about tax expenditures having to be reviewed every 6 years. So, you know, I prefer dash 2, which is the Chris Allen Act. amendment. Chris also asked me to talk to the ODOT tax manager and ask him. And he said that he does not believe that this is a tax expenditure. And I asked him what's going to happen to this program. And he said that he doesn't see it in the law anywhere where he has to do away with the program. So it's going to continue as far as he is concerned. Hearing that, Chris has said, well, maybe you don't need to do anything, but if you do want to pass a bill, maybe you might, or pass an amendment, you might pass the dash 2. The ODOT tax manager also had something interesting to say that I think is a repercussion of a bigger discussion that you need to have. He said that there are no takers for the fuel decal program this year, and I think people found out that, you know, the bill didn't pass last session and they thought the program was going away. It also could be part of the issue that some people see this program as being very expensive. In Washington, they give some incentives for clean fuels by making anybody who participates in the fuel decal program, it's a lower rate, and they have a very robust program up there. I brought these two amendments to you so you could have a bigger discussion on who should decide what is a tax expenditure, because the fuel decal program is a perfect example. Is this a Department of Revenue chore to simply list things, or should the legislature be making that decision? So thank you.
Questions? All right. We'll continue looking at this, Lana. Thank you. We are about out of time, and we're going to hold a public hearing work session on this again tomorrow. So if I could have your indulgence, Deanna. Others. We're going to have to close. We have a committee member appointments. So we'll take both of these bills up again tomorrow, 1531 and 1565. So with that, we are adjourned.